Good to have you on. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, man. So after two times, does this make me an honorary dignitary?
Yes, yes. You are approaching honorary dignitary status, my man. And
I need to buy a new suit.
That's all.
Well, clearly dress code is no impediment, as anybody watching the webcam can see. But anyways, it's all part of having fun with the program here. And you were originally booked tonight by our New York bureau, Steve Cervillo, to discuss the Ted Kennedy situation here. So we'll start with that. The end of an era in American politics with the three Kennedy brothers. And the outpouring that we saw last week, to a minor extent, a little bit surprising, the extent to which it was across the political spectrum, especially in light of the known partisanship of Ted Kennedy. Although, again, you know, as people have also talked about, you know, deal making and everything like that, the cynic in me says that he was a deal maker when he could get things his way, like snookering George Bush into selling out poor kids and dropping vouchers from No Child Left Behind. I mean, Ted Kennedy never seemed to walk out of any negotiation empty-handed, but it was quite an interesting media portrayal of the passing of this man who was indeed a legend.
Well, you know, every time somebody dies, they suddenly get a lot better. The
yeah,
same thing
true.
Happened with Reagan. The same thing happened with Nixon. The same thing will happen with any of us. You know, you don't say bad things about the dead.
True.
So, you know, it makes sense to me that they would lionize. I mean, it was a little strange because it was strange to hear people to whom, you know, liberal is a nasty word, praising Ted Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no, he's a fascinating character. I mean, my God, think of all the threads that come together in that one story.
It just... And here's the thing also, too. Maybe I'm reading way too much into this, okay? But being, you know, a child of the 80s political climate and everything like that, it was talked about over the weekend and you know, last week also during the funeral coverage about remember the days when, you know, Ted Kennedy was, you know, the bane of the direct mail campaigns, and I'm going to go to D.C. and save you from Ted Kennedy. I mean, maybe it's that I still have that image in my head and the way that a lot of Americans look at him, but I think to myself, when I hear Barack Obama calling him, you know, all the things that he's called him, you know, the greatest senator of our time and everything like that, one wonders at a time when Obama's poll numbers are already taking a little bit of a dip, that are some of the same people with whom those numbers are taking a dip, people who are not going to be favorably inclined to hear Ted Kennedy described in such a way, or am I kind of reaching here?
Oh, I think you're reaching. I mean, funerals and commemorations, you know, those are times that we all want to say the best things that we can. I mean, yeah, of course, you can't separate a life like Ted Kennedy's from politics. But, I mean, if you're going to talk about somebody who actually got legislation done, I mean, this is a guy whose name is in some way associated with, you know, every piece, or not every piece, but probably more pieces of major legislation than just about anybody in the last half century. And if you want to talk, you know, No Child Left Behind, believe me, the liberals feel that they got snookered by that one just as much as you do. I mean, you will not hear liberals praise No Child Left Behind unless they think they're getting votes.
That's kind of funny because, you know, it looked like a pretty statist piece of legislation to me from where I sit. But that's, you know.
Well,
that's,
you know, you sit next to Pat Buchanan.
Well,
man.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, hey, I'm a fan of Paleo Pat. What can I tell you? But, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to me to see No Child Left Behind criticized from the left, of all things.
Well, that's the way we all are, though.
You know, that's true.
I think conservatives don't understand the range of opinions that exist on the left, and I think the left is the same way. I think that I've just actually had email discussions with a good friend of mine who claims he's given up talking to Republicans because he doesn't think any of them are reasonable. Well, I mean, I know my friend, and I imagine they don't find him terribly reasonable either, but he's sort of lumped all these people into one category. But my God, there's an enormous range of opinion. I have a good friend on the Republican side, John Hinckley. I'll give him a shout out.
Uh-huh.
He has been being pounced on all over the place in the last couple of days because he's a traditional libertarian, and he wants the Republican Party to kind of disavow the birthers and the extremists.
You know, and I can understand that, but there's another libertarian point that I was making to you off air here today that as you look at this present healthcare debate, I know the way that things are going, it strikes me that there is going to be a price to be paid for trying to win the way that Republicans are trying to win right now, because it's one thing when Democrats go to scare old people, because you know what? At least they're consistent, okay?
Nancy Pelosi. That's funny. I like your formulation.
Well, sure. Listen, I'm all about intellectual honesty, Colin. You know what? Just come from the place you're coming from, and just, as Vince McMahon would say, let's just go there then, okay? Nancy Pelosi is a cradle-to-grave statist, okay? So if she's going to scare old people, it's like, that's what she does. John Boehner is not supposed to be about endless giveaways to old people, okay? If the Republicans are going to plausibly claim they learned anything from George W. Bush and his Medicare prescription drug boondoggle and the unfunded giveaway to old folks that's going to bankrupt us along with everything else that we're doing right now, how can they claim they've learned anything from that when they're trying to get in some ways to the left of Democrats on this health care debate? It just makes me want to pull my hair out because, as I've said to you, I'm an ideologue, not a partisan. I'm not a guy who identifies himself as a Republican.
I understand completely what you're saying, because you have to stand for something.
Yeah.
And, you know, the danger an opposition party, you know, or a party in opposition, a party out of power, always has a delicate balance to maintain, right? Because you are trying to stop the other guy as much as you can, but without tarnishing yourself at the same time. The problem that I think the Republicans in Congress have is, just as on, you know, family values, you have people saying one thing and doing another too often. I mean, if a Democrat gets busted for cheating on his wife,
right,
it's one thing, because, you know, you guys expect Democrats to do that,
sure,
right?
Permissiveness.
But when a Republican who runs on a family values ticket, you know, votes for to impeach Clinton and blah, 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 when he gets busted by that, that fundamentally undermines credibility. And when Republican candidates or Republican office holders do things that you guys see as being left-wing, I think that undermines their credibility in exactly the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you got to be consistent on stuff. You got to go about things in a way, because the worm's going to turn. I mean, the Republicans at some point, And believe me, in the last 2 years or so of George W. Bush, it looked like it would be another generation down the road. But these things inevitably turn. Republicans will be back in the majority at some point.
At some point, of course. It may take a while.
Yeah.
With the current leadership, it's going to take a while.
Oh, exactly. Because every gain they're making right now is purely because of Democrat ineptitude. There's nothing that is due to the brilliance of John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, please. It's not
I have to give credit to the people on, you know, we talked, you and I earlier when we were chatting, a little bit about healthcare, and I have to give an immense amount of credit to the people who are pumping out negative messages on healthcare reform. And some of them are being completely intellectually honest, no problem at all. Some of them are saying things that, you know, of course, turn out not to be true, but the sort of the degree to which they're putting out an effective message that the Democrats weren't even beginning to counter until just about 3 weeks ago. I mean, I'm a little bit in awe.
Yeah, and it's true that the Republican strength, such as it's been, has come from the outside, from some of the new media types, from some of the interest groups that have organized and everything like that. But I'd like to explore also the question of intellectual honesty with you, especially being something that we talked about off air here today, because...
Well, you know, I'm not a close acquaintance with intellectual honesty personally, but I'll do my best.
Well, and I try to be a fanatic about it, such that, you know, my brother loves to try to catch me in contradictions whenever I can, because I'm so fastidious about pointing them out with other people. So I'm probably setting myself up here, you know, by approaching it this way, but when you look at it, when you look at the situation here again, and there's death panels, there's a thing where I like to throw it around in casual conversation just to piss people off, just because, you know, you're demagoguing this, you know, but that's I like to do it just to have fun. But as far as how it actually relates to this thing here, Colin, I agree with you. There's nothing in this thing explicitly that calls for that, anything like that, but again, and as much as people are going to hear this as a dirty word name when I bring it up, Glenn Beck, if you follow the reasoning as he's traced it through, as universal health care developed from the Weimar Republic in Germany to what they had in the 30s and then into the 40s. And again, Nazism, that's all loaded, whatever. But if we can peel away the names and what you call it and you get to the reasoning of it, you get to these quality of life issues. There will never be anything called death panels just because, A, it's bad PR. We're seeing that now. But in terms of there being a process by which old people have to justify at a certain point in time, you know, like, hey, can you do this for me to help me live another 2 or 3 years?
You hear these things. I just want to jump in.
Sure.
Where do you guys think? This is America.
Yeah.
You know, these are American Congress members. These are people that we elected.
Right.
These bureaucrats and a bureaucratic system that would be composed of our fellow citizens. Americans wouldn't stand for something like that. We have rationing right now. It's called, if you can afford it, you get it. If you can't afford it, you don't until you go to the emergency room.
Okay.
Where, you know, I have to, you know, I go back to, I don't know if you saw it, but the thing with Barney Frank, where he was talking to the woman who, you know, makes a Nazi analogy. And, by the way, German universal health care actually dates way before Hitler.
Sure.
It dates back to, I think, the 1880s. Bismarck was basically co-opting the labor unions.
Right.
It was a way to bring the socialists into the state.
Right.
60 years before Hitler.
Sure.
And you know, sort of universally applied health care exists in every single, industrialized country, you know, except for the United States.
Right.
But, wow, you actually got me a little excited here. That's unusual for radio. But I would just say that I can take any piece of writing and I can read an extreme set of interpretations into it. But that doesn't mean that that's a realistic expectation. You can, you know, read a sentence of legalese and put it together with three other things. But until you have evidence that that's really the way it's going to be set up, it's just crazy talk.
Well, from my perspective, and again, I'm somebody who, social issues aside and national security issues aside, and I realize those are two pretty big asides, but I'm basically libertarian aside from that, okay?
Sure,
so as I
right,
approach it, you saying what you said about the bureaucracy composed of our citizens, I'll be honest, makes me giggle. Has a bureaucracy ever been responsive, Colin, to the will of the people? It doesn't happen.
And insurance companies are?
No, not necessarily.
I mean, you want to compare Medicare versus insurance companies. Medicare has a 5% administrative cost rate, and it doesn't turn anybody down for anything. Insurance companies have 20 to 25% administrative costs, and they make your life a living hell. But there is no benefit to the system because they ultimately do approve the things. They just make everyone in the system jump through an enormous number of hoops. That's not efficient. That's not intelligent.
Is there not anything to the argument that I think I've heard democracy described as the worst system in the world aside from all the others? When you look at everything that we're going through right now, and again, I say this again, I am an idealist from my point of view, okay? I want to see access strengthened. I want to see these issues. I mean, I'm not captain status quo on any of this stuff, and I have friends who are going through some of these issues and uninsured and all that kind of stuff. But is there, when you look at the macro, is there not something to be said that, you know, what we have now is the worst possible system aside from all others? When you look at people in Canada who are on lists for years and years and years.
Canada is a great example. Why are people in Canada on lists? Because Canada historically underfunded the system that they built. They built an elaborate system. They pay half as much per person on health care as we do. They're in the process right now of upping their health care spending by about 10 or 20%. Over what they're doing, which will still have them at about 60% of our spending or whatever, however that ends up. But that'll get rid of the lines. The British system gets criticized all the time. They, again, have grossly underfunded what they built. Again, they spend like half as much per person as we do. The German system is probably more analogous to what we would end up with because it has private health insurance companies, but it has tight government regulation, and it has, you know, guaranteed health care for all. But they still have private health insurance companies.
Yeah, and that's which we're going to have allegedly as this continues on. Although I think without the public option in there, and there was word that came today that Obama might be backing away from that. Without a public option, it seems a stronger case that there is going to be continuing public or private insurance companies in this country. Before we get into any of the Obama stuff, which I know I want to get into, you have a great ebook.
Yeah,
on the site here, as just an interregnum before we get to that, I got a question here from Mr. Servillo that he would like me to ask you about cash for clunkers, how you see that situation, in a political sense, how that thing played out. For somebody like me who just has an inherent suspicion of any type of government, tinkering with markets and everything like that, I think there's a certain burden of proof here that's going to have to play out to make sure that we didn't steal sales, quote unquote, from, September, October, November, as this thing goes. Everybody knows that the market is predicated on incentives and disincentives. You had strong incentives for the short term and everything like that. I think it also probably remains to be seen whether or not we didn't set up a repeat of the housing situation where we were pushing people into things that maybe they weren't in a position to afford. How do you see this as having unfolded?
Well, we'll know in 6 months or a year. But, the stats that I've heard so far say that a good chunk of the cars that were bought by people who don't buy cars very often, who are sort of bargain shoppers, and it might have pushed them to get a car a year or two earlier than they otherwise would. But, the guys whose plants got reopened in the Midwest are probably pretty happy about the thing. I suspect it's more PR and psychological than anything that has a real sort of structural effect on the economy. But, there is something to be said for PR. But I'm glad they stopped it when they did. They should, whatever benefit it was going to give, it had given.
Yeah, I think that definitely is the case. We're coming up on the anniversary of September 15th from last year, when everything really was shaken to its core with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and everything that came about that week. And we've seen things in the last year. It's just striking, Colin, that unfathomable in our lifetimes that we would be seeing situations. Earlier this year, when Obama essentially fired the head of General Motors, I said at the time on this show, I said, I can't believe that this guy's barely been president, and we've seen something that's guaranteed to end up in his presidential museum. You don't often see that in the first month or two somebody's in office where it's like, wow, they're going to have like a room on this or whatever in the Obama Museum. And like, that's historic with a capital H right there. It's amazing times we live in.
What's the old Chinese curse? May you live an interesting time.
Yeah. who could have fathomed government and business and everything like that being as intertwined as they've been over the course of the last year? These are things.
I would argue that they've been intertwined.
True.
It's just that now we can really see the tentacles, because the financial industry was about as far from a free market as you were ever going to get. It may not have the things that went crazy may not have been government regulated, but it wasn't a free market. It was being manipulated by players in that market. That's one reason that we do regulate securities markets, is to keep people from using positions of power to shift them. And, you look at if you're going to say government and business and industry being interrelated, there is a special and magic relationship between Congress members and defense contractors that dates back at least to the Eisenhower age.
You're right about that, and I would say that again for a paleo like me, there's much to criticize about that as well, the way that these things have gotten intertwined over time here. But I definitely wanted to take some time also, we'll do this in the last couple minutes of the segment here with you, to talk about this ebook that you've got on your site. I've not gotten a chance to read it yet, but as a political junkie, looking forward to doing this. The title of it is called Learning from Obama, Lessons for Online Communicators in 2009 and Beyond. And as I said to you off air, I find it fascinating because, again, it to me, it's one of the greatest accomplishments in American political history, what they were able to do electing a guy last year. And people are going to say, well, you mean because they elected a black president? No, that's not nearly what I'm talking about here. But essentially, somebody of his public positions, for one thing.
Right. A junior senator, when he declared, he was all of 2 years out of the Illinois State Senate. And the last time we saw anything like that was JFK. JFK had still been in the Senate well, certainly longer than probably Barack Obama had been in public life.
Oh, yeah.
But it was amazing. One of the things that made me take a really good look at Obama was how well he ran his campaign, because he was functionally running a multi-$100 million corporation. And he ran it with an efficiency that we've never really seen before. And if you want to, as we were talking about earlier, if you want to see a comparison, just look at what the successor organization is trying to do with his massive list of supporters on healthcare. And so far, they've been able to do very little because they don't have the structure and they don't have the resources that the Obamans had during the actual campaign.
I will say this. I will concede you that point, because I'm somebody who... I do take the view that a lot of people have of politicians, and a lot of it seems to be disproportionately Democratic politicians, of guys never run a payroll in his life. He's an academic. He's an egghead. He's done this. There is something to be said for that organization was similar in many ways to, I guess, a Fortune 500 company or whatever the case may be, of being the CEO of a large enterprise. Being the head of a campaign, your own one, whatever the case may be, doesn't generally qualify for you for that. I reluctantly concede that he was the exception to that rule.
Well, think about the difference between a President Kerry and a President Obama.
Ugh.
Or a President Hillary Clinton and a President Obama. My God, Hillary couldn't even keep her own people from squabbling with each other in public. You know what
right.
I mean? That was one of the things that honestly, seriously, really turned, as a Democrat, that was one of the things that really turned me off to her, was how poorly she ran that. If she couldn't run her own campaign well, why should I trust her to run the country?
Well, that's a very good question when you pose it that way. And I would say also, too, because, again, you look at the unlikelihood of it and everything like that, and people want to go to race when you talk about that. To me, black guy, that's the tip of the iceberg with the unlikelihood, because, as you said, junior senator, somebody who'd only been on the stage a few years, if you really think about it, and I was thinking about this at one point, being the political nerd that I am, most presidents are at least even vaguely on the radar somewhere at least a decade before they get elected president. Even somebody like Bill Clinton, you maybe had to be a political junkie to an extent.
Right.
But Southern governor in the early 80s, the hot talk was this guy had a future. Going back in time,
mm-hmm.
I mean, 10 years ago. Kennedy
was being talked about in the mid-40s.
Yeah.
Because his Harvard thesis, which I think may have been ghostwritten, but don't quote me. His Harvard thesis got published as a book by, you know, Joe Kennedy, basically, to get, you know, Kennedy's name out there.
John F. Kennedy wrote all his own stuff. Ted Torrenson. But anyways.
Like I said, I wasn't in the room.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, in terms of how this stuff goes, I would say also the political positions as well. It's another thing we talked about off air, because this is a man who, while not overtly a man of the left, the closest we'd seen since Lyndon Johnson, and if you look at the fact that the left really sort of got redefined in the 1960s, that means that he's about the closest we've ever seen to an overt man of the left, such that when you look at his policy positions, you know, I'll bet you even Amy Goodman probably cracked a smile once or twice during the campaign looking at the prospect of this guy getting elected.
Well, I just don't see that at all. When I look at Obama, I see a guy who knows how to compromise. I don't expect Obama to speak out a radical position on anything, ever, honestly. It's just not his nature. There is a caricature of him out there that doesn't match him at all. He is a centrist. He has angered a lot of the left by sending more troops to Afghanistan. He never claimed to be anti-war. He just was against the war in Iraq. He thought the war in Afghanistan was a good idea.
How do you square that with the 97% ADU voting record?
I can cherry pick votes and make anything happen. Those things are propaganda. The conservative rating, the liberal rating on this, they cherry pick votes to get the results they want. Don't believe any of that.
Yeah.
That's just spin. That's just designed to get a newspaper story.
I don't know, because I think you could trace McCain's squishing over the years by those ratings. I think it kind of, you know, I place
well,
more.
Again, that's probably why they invented those ratings.
Well, I don't know. I place more stock in those than you do, clearly. But it's the whole notion of, see, here's the thing on Afghanistan. This is my take on it. My take is his bluff got called, because I think Democrats essentially, and I say this as a paleocon, I'm as against the neocons as a lot of people. I'm also against the pacifists. I see a lot of the Democratic establishment as being pacifist, but basically it's like World War II. It's like, oh, but we respect the good war. World War II was the good war.
May I just point out that it was Democrats post-war who've launched more wars than Republicans. Democrats got us into Korea. Democrats got us in Vietnam. Even in the last couple of decades, you've got Kosovo. And some people argue that Democrats are actually under more pressure to be militaristic in the same way that only Nixon could go to China. That Dems have to prove that they're strong,
Colin,
where Republicans are assumed to be strong in those issues.
Honestly,
so I think a Democrat's actually more likely to take you to war than a Republican.
But honestly, Colin, I look at the Democrats after the new left took over the party in the late 60s, early 70s, the ultimate long march of the McGovern movement that I think was successful in the party. In that era, I see a strong strain of pacifism. As a matter of fact, you know, call me cynical if you will, but on Kosovo, which I opposed strenuously because I didn't think it had anything to do with our national security, to me, Democrats seem more inclined on stuff that has nothing to do with our national security, but that's feel-good stuff and, oh, well, we're going to go rescue some poor people here and everything like that, as opposed to national security. I see Afghanistan as getting the bluff called, kind of like when they were out of power. Oh, well, Afghanistan's the place where we should be going and getting them. Now they're in office, like, oh, crap, we got to follow through on this.
I just don't think that. Look, Barack Obama is a serious person. He doesn't. I mean, that's just not. That's utterly out of character for him. From everything I've ever read about him, he took. I mean, he was in favor from 2000. When did we go in? 2001.
Yeah.
Whenever he would have had a chance to be on the permanent record, he has been in favor of military intervention in Afghanistan. It is not remotely a change, unless you're going to say that he was pre-planning his 2008 presidential position back in 2003. Which isn't rational.
Well, you know, and that part of it's true because he was an unknown at the time, but there were a lot of, you know, look, Barbara Lee of the Bay Area was the only vote against Afghanistan in 2001. I mean, everybody had hawkishness in them to some extent, you know, back at the time here. For as much as everybody said, we'll never forget what it was like, we'll never forget, it seems like most people did. So you're telling me, and I want to believe this, by the way, as somebody who knows that we need to get this right there and wipe out Al-Qaeda, you're telling me he's not going to use the George Wills of the world as political cover to get us out of there and duck and run?
Well, I don't really know who reads George Will anymore, but George Will, considering he hasn't had an original idea in about 20 years.
Amen to that.
That's a separate question entirely.
That guy sucks, by the way.
You know, I think you judge somebody by their actions, not by what you think their motives might be.
Okay.
And since Barack Obama has come into office, he has pulled troops out of the Iraqi cities. He has redeployed troops to the tune of something like 24,000 promised so far to Afghanistan. He's increased our troop strength in Afghanistan by something like a third. If you're going to say that he's doing it for motives that he's faking, that's great. But you still have to judge him by what he's doing. What is he going to do? Pull out earlier than you think after sending everyone there? You see what I mean? I don't understand the logic.
Well,
if he's sending people there, that's what we should judge him by.
Well, and last question I have for you here. Again, I say this as somebody who, again, I'll say I was squeamish at the time the Iraq war started, have come to realize, you know, clearly, again, there was something to my squeamishness and we shouldn't have gone in there. But I was in favor of the surge when it happened because it was like, we can't afford to leave a debacle behind, okay?
Right.
So, and I was right about the surge. It worked, okay? Interesting that a guy who still can't bring himself to say a nice word about the surge seems to be using the same strategy in Afghanistan.
Well, you know what? Welcome to politics, my friend. And a lot of people would say the surge is one of the three things that worked in Iraq. One was the spontaneous Anbar awakening, where the Sunnis themselves made strategic decisions. Another one was our paying the Sunnis to make the right decision. And then the third one was the influx of troops.
Sure.
But no, I agree. I think it would be politically much more intelligent for Obama to say something nice about the surge. But, I mean, is it a mistake to learn from your mistakes?
Well, no,
We went through 8 years of a guy who didn't learn from his mistakes.
Well, and I regard the surge actually as a combination of the three things you talked about. But like yourself, I'm a sophisticated fellow here, so you know that's why I look at it the way that I do.
But,
Colin, at as I feared, that the time with you has run way too fast here. We're already over by a minute or so. But anyways, I just want to give you a chance to plug anything at all possible here on epolitics.com. We also have the link on the fdhlounge.com to the ebook, Learning from Obama, Lessons for Online Communicators in 2009 and Beyond. Anything else that we're missing here that the peeps should know about?
Well, I should know that the ebook is actually just a free PDF. It's not a Kindle book or anything like that. It's nothing that anybody needs to pay for. I'm just trying to get these ideas out there. Uh-huh. I want as many political junkies to read the sucker as possible because it tells you what really happened. There was so much hype and so much, so many people kind of missed a lot of the point of what really went on, what really worked in 2008.
Yeah.
And I went out of my way to try to find that out and nail that down, so that the next people, regardless of whether they're on the left or the right, don't have to make the same mistakes over again.
I'm looking forward to reading it, and I am hopeful that as the cliches about the evil party and the stupid party, as somebody who votes most of the time for the stupid party, hoping that they get their head out of their ass, and hopefully your book will inadvertently show them the way.
Well, I tell you, I'd much rather have ideologues around than people that I don't know when they're going to stab you in the back. You know what I mean?
Honestly, when I went to college and I was friends with a band of ideologues on the one side, we had more respect for the hippies and a lot of them guys like that. We seem to have a lot more in common than the careerist types in Student Senate, the middle-of-the-road types that didn't stand for anything. It's hard to respect those people as much for somebody like me.
I understand. That's why George Bush never quite won y'all over.
No, he didn't. He didn't. I sensed the guy was a phony back in 2000. Nobody listened to me. And as usual, when people didn't listen to me, the world went to hell in a handbasket. But Colin.
Well done.
Yeah, exactly. I'm modest on top of everything else. Colin, a lot of fun as always. We won't. I think you were on episode 55. That makes 16 episodes in between. We got to make sure that it's not nearly that many until we get you back on.
Absolutely, man. It was a total hoot.